Welcome to Growth Marketing Today, where marketers, designers, and product owners level up their growth marketing chops from experts in today's top startups. Here's your host, Ramley John.
Welcome to episode 76 of Growth Marketing Today. I'm your host, Ramley John, and I'm here on a mission to help marketers and founders like you sharpen their marketing skills by talking to some of today's top experts. This is the last episode of 2019. This is it for this decade, and I hope you had a great holiday, so took a break. I actually got sick over the holidays. My throat is still a little sore, but I didn't want to hold you back from, I think, one of the best episodes of this year. And today I have Derek Gleason. He is a content lead at CXL. If you don't know what CXL is, they are this place that a lot of marketers look up to for content, including myself. This episode is all about how CXL increased website traffic by 130% in 12 months by updating old blog posts. Well, why would you want to even update your old blog posts? Just like you regularly clean your kitchen to keep cobwebs and cockroaches away, you should regularly update old content. If you do, the results can be extraordinary. And I just talked about how CXL was able to increase their website traffic by 130% in 12 months by just updating articles they've written before. Now, Derek Gleason, he's a content lead at CXL, describes exactly what they did to achieve that in this episode. This episode is so good. I had such a good chat with him about all the things that he's done. In this episode, you'll learn the difference between good content and bad content. Second, how CXL increased the website traffic, exactly the process they did, how to select which content to update. And third, how to rank high in search engines and how to maintain it. Before we jump in, I just want to thank those who made this episode possible. These folks helped cover the cost of hosting and marketing tools so I can focus on getting amazing experts that you and I can learn from. I want to thank the sponsor for this episode, Rank Science. Now, Rank Science is the easiest way to grow organic traffic and get your content ranking higher in Google. If you're an SEO, this thing is cool. It allows you to A/B test your SEO for your landing pages so that you know which ones are actually causing an uplift in the search ranking. Sign up for a risk-free 30-day trial at rankscience.com/growth today. You can find that link in the description. Enough about this. Let's jump in my chat with Derek.
Hey, everybody. I'm excited to have Derek from CXL on this podcast. I'm excited because I've been following their blog. I taught a course with Conversion XL, and you know, I'm really excited because Conversion XL is a company that a lot of marketers look up to. How's it going there? How are things with you?
It's good. It's this is like the 2 weeks I get a year, like December, when we don't publish anything. So this is the big exhale before we ramp back up for another 90 or so posts next year.
Exciting. Well, I'm actually going to be posting this up 2 weeks from now. So it'll be around that time when you're not really like ramping up with content. Any plans for the holidays?
Maybe not doing stuff or not traveling. We literally, so in August, my wife and I just moved back from 2.5 years in Sierra Leone in West Africa. Wow. So we've gotten like the fix of traveling in for a while. And so of course, like as soon as we got back, then all the family's like, oh, hey, why don't you come visit us now that you're back in the States? So yeah, so like this weekend will be three straight weekends of traveling. So the goal is to sort of to live the lifestyle that my dog enjoys every day, which is leaving the couch as little as possible.
It's funny, I'm kind of the opposite way. My wife, I convinced her to quit her work so that we can travel for like 6 months. She's a Montessori teacher. I was like, you know, just quit and go to Thailand for like 6 months. Or did you say Sierra Leone? How is that place?
Yeah. So my wife works for the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, so the CDC. So she started going there in 2014 when the Ebola outbreak was going on. And she was like back and forth for 3 years. And then we moved in 2017. So, I mean, it's pretty underdeveloped. The best internet speed I could get was about 6 megabits per second.
No. And that's sad.
And that was hundreds of dollars per month for that privilege. So as a remote employee there, it was kind of interesting. On the flip side, for CXL, half our company's in Austin and half is in Estonia. So I was like right in the middle of the time zone. So that part was kind of ideal. But yeah, I don't miss like just waking up every morning and hoping that the internet's working. It's certainly a great experience. We haven't figured out what you guys have, which is like get both spouses on the remote work plan or the flexible plan, because we're in Atlanta now because that's where CDC headquarters is. But it's like I have my remote benefits are basically allowing me to follow my wife around, which I've done about a half dozen times over the last few years.
That's pretty cool. I think that's definitely the benefit of remote work. Anyway, let's talk about that. I mean, I didn't know you were in Sierra Leone for a little bit. Can you tell a little bit about your journey and your story about how you became the content lead at CXL?
Sure. Well, that move to Sierra Leone was actually the catalyst. At the time, before we moved, I was working as an SEO, doing some content stuff, but basically SEO for most of my work at an agency in Virginia. And then when I moved over, I became a contractor for them instead of a full-time employee. So I love the company, love the people there, but I was remote. Like, work was like sometimes more, some months, sometimes less. And so I wasn't really actively looking for anything, but I saw that Pep, in classic Pep fashion, tweeted out that he had been looking to replace his content person since Alex and Chanel had moved on. And he's like, "I've looked at hundreds of applications and they all suck."
Which, that sounds like him.
It sounds exactly like him. And so, of course, I was like, I'm not really looking to change right now, but let's see if I suck too. So I was like, I'll throw my name in and we'll see if I get punted out of this as well as part of the people who suck. And it just went through a few phases of interview and sort of test content and worked out. And that was, I guess, about a year and a half ago. So he was bold enough to hire somebody that was living in Sierra Leone that he'd never met. And I think I was working for the company for probably 6 months before I actually met anybody. So it was a true test of the new remote existence in the world.
How was that first experience when you finally got a chance to like talk to him on like Skype or Zoom?
Sure. I mean, so we had a couple of audio only interviews, but I mean, even like video interviews with my internet was always sort of a cross your fingers and hope for the best. It was the most fun when I finally went back. So we have an annual conference we do in Austin called CXL Live. When I went back for that, because basically everybody in the company was smashed into a single Airbnb. And after months of talking to these people on Slack and having video chats or audio chats, it was like seeing all these minor celebrities, because it was all these people who I knew their headshots from Slack and I had talked to them, whatever, I'd never seen them in person. So like, oh, hey, product manager guy. So it was probably like an unnecessary amount of enthusiasm from my end. But no, it's been great. And it's great. You know, if you ever work with clients, the more time you spend with people, the easier it is to do the business stuff, because the more natural the communication flow tends to be.
I'm curious, is Pepas is he the same on Twitter as he is in real life? Because I've never met him, and I'm actually thinking about going to CXL Live next year, so maybe I'll come across him.
Yeah, CXL Live is super fun. Not to plug it, but the one difference is that everybody's stuck on a resort for a few days. So if you actually do come to meet and hang out with people, especially presenters or Pep or whatever else, we're all there the whole time. So you do get to hang out. But no, Pep is 100% that guy. Like, very much he will tell you what he thinks. And this is, you know, it's, I think for some people, maybe there's probably like an initial shock value where you have to get over it at first, because you can't take it personally, because he is very, ultimately very, I was going to say warm, which is totally true, but like, he's very generous, very fair, but he will also just tell it like it is. And he doesn't suffer fools or bad ideas. And I think for him, one of the things I remember hearing was, you know, if you throw an idea out there on Slack, he thinks best case scenario is to create a conversation, even like an argument about it. So often his first reaction is going to be to challenge that idea, not in a way to try to shut you down, but try to say, like, all right, like, give me the perspective on this, like, build out the full argument in favor of this before I just say yes or no. So it's, once I sort of figured that out, it's been really, I think it's a good way if you want to get in and have a lot of ideas challenged and be sort of forced to really think through things. I think that's probably at the end of the day, is he's looking to make sure that people have thought things through. But I would say, like, the stuff that would have given me like an anxiety attack on day one, I now laugh about. It's not like, all right, let's go. Come on, I'll do this on Slack. Let's get it after it. Come on. So yeah, it took a little time though.
That's I guess that's good. I mean, like, you want people who are as real, you know, you don't want people to be fake on Twitter and like be different in person, right? So that's sure. Totally a good thing.
No, it's 100%. And I think it's a challenge from the content perspective, because he really, certainly the company was built off the blog that he started doing. And the blog was very much written in his own voice. And a large part of the appeal was that it really was a matter of fact. It was like jargon free, like, here's the deal. This is great. This is bullshit. Like, no veneer, just calling it like it is and trying to actually get past whatever marketing mumbo jumbo there is, the stuff that actually works. And I think that was a big part of what initially made the blog successful. And it's also to me, a very challenging thing to try to keep going, partly because of my own, it's not necessarily my natural voice, but also it does take a lot of knowledge and expertise, and it's a challenge to be able to simplify concepts without kind of being reductionist.
I want to talk about you, and one of the things that I didn't know, and you mentioned before we chatted, is that you used to edit encyclopedias. First of all, why?
It's still my dream job. So I love the work. I mean, to go back to the recurring theme, the partial why is because we had moved again for my wife's work, and so I was looking for a job, and this came open, and this was in Cleveland, Ohio. But it's thing that I've always been most interested in is where are people producing the sort of definitive, authoritative version of content, wherever that happens to be. And obviously, encyclopedias have a reputation for doing that. They're what, in sort of like the nerdy sense, they're called tertiary sources, in that they're not primary sources. They're not going to have actual interviews. They're not going to run interviews to get information. They're not going to be the write-ups of those things. They're basically the write-ups of the write-ups. And that's what you're doing. So it's, you're doing a lot of distillation of looking at kind of all the research that's out there and pulling it all together, and then trying to put that together initially often for a lay adult. But then we were also working on encyclopedia sets that were for various school ages. So you might start with, this is the version for the lay adults that gets sold to public libraries. And then you need to make a version for high schoolers, middle schoolers, elementary schoolers. So it was a phenomenal way to get tons and tons of practice of, again, sort of going back to what Pep did and what I try to maintain with the CXL blog, which is that very straightforward, honest, to the point kind of writing can be very tricky. And to have that experience, I think, of distilling that content over and over. And again, starting at the highest source, in the same way that you look at old CXL articles, Pep loves to cite, you know, psychological studies and that kind of stuff. He loves to go all the way up to that highest level of information, but then take it down and figure out what are the practical applications of it.
And so you did, you edited some encyclopedias. What are some lessons that you took from that experience to now what you're applying to your work with CXL?
Sure. I mean, there's at a baseline, there's an expectation sort of sourcing quality, of copy editing that are standards in encyclopedias that generally surpass what people expect with blogs. I think one of the challenges that I see from some people in content marketing is they start on the marketing side and they've never really been in a serious content side. And I think it's probably harder to get a feel for what very serious content looks like, that has to be the kind of quality that you can sell to someone, not just like sell for money, not just get a link or a share. I think it's much harder to go from marketer to content marketer than it is to go from content person to content marketer. They both certainly have challenges, but that's one of the baselines, is just having several years of doing that. Other things is, I think from a topical perspective, when you're looking at selling information, one of the people who owned the company, he used to have the saying of, it has to be need to know, hard to find. So when you're looking at what kind of topic should I choose, need to know is differentiates itself from nice to know. So nice to know is kind of like, oh, that's interesting, but I'm not really going to do with it. Need to know is the stuff that you absolutely have to know. That's what you want to get in there. And then the hard to find component is something, in some ways, is kind of a vestige of the pre-internet era, where it used to actually be like really hard to find statistics on things or other bits of information. So you're including information people couldn't get elsewhere. In the modern context, I think hard to find tends to be, it might be information that's buried in a PDF on some government website that has, you know, horrible SEO that you're never going to find otherwise. Or it could just be that it's like a huge overwhelming report, like you take census data and you're distilling it and pulling out the little bits and pieces that people know. So it's sort of making it easier to find, even though somebody could find it, you're helping make that experience more efficient for them. So from an informational perspective, that's kind of another one that I look at. And then I also happened to be there at the time when we were doing like the last print editions of everything before we migrated everything over to digital, which you can imagine how much fun that was. This was a company that for the last 20 or 30 years had been built on selling print editions that they did revisions of about every 5 years, to all of a sudden you're selling an online subscription product. A very, very different experience. But print is something that I wish everybody could have a chance to do, and most people never will. But some of the lessons that you take away from doing print is, for one, you have to make lots of choices that you don't have to make, often with like things like length. So we had a 13 volume set of sports biographies for like middle schoolers. The idea was like for reluctant readers, it was something they would read because they're, you know, sports biographies. Well, every one of those had to be like 1700 words. So obviously you write a draft and it's 2,500, 3,000 words. Online, we would just throw it up there, publish, not worry about it. You know, when you go to print, every page costs money. You have to have consistency. People expect that like every third page they turn to is a new full page image with a new biography. So you end up having to make choices that honestly are very painful at times because you're cutting out stuff that you think is relevant, but you have to make those choices. So it gives you the experience of making those choices, which is, you know, when you look at kind of the evolution of content on the internet, it started out with people just publishing garbage more or less, or like really short articles. And I think we've gone through the phase of how long can I publish something? And people are sort of, at least I'm getting kind of exasperated with that. Like, I'm not excited about your new 6,000 word article. Like, I don't have time to read this. And so where the thing is coming back a bit is now it's more about content density. And I think to increase that kind of density, that's one of those things where I think if you say to yourself, okay, every blog post that we're going to write is going to be between 2,000 and 2,500 words, no exceptions, that's going to force you to make some editorial decisions that the structure of publishing online will never make you do. But I think as far as having some consistency in a brand and really forcing you to distill some things more than you otherwise would, it's something that certainly I think about a lot.
That's interesting you say that. And I never thought about it that way, but you're right. With print, you probably have limited pages. Each page that you print would cost you more money. And that's why, you know, are you finding there's, because of, you know, like web, there's a lot of really bad content out there. And one of the articles that you posted up, it's like a lot of the bad content actually gets linked the most sometimes.
Sure. You know, that's a sort of a different challenge. And that's, I think, more a conversation kind of about measurement, adding context to measurement. But from a print perspective, definitely the choices are there. It also kind of plays in with some of the differences between the kind of choices of doing evergreen versus stuff that changes all the time. As far as the costs that are there, one of the things that we noticed that changed from the print to the digital age was people's expectations of what qualifies as up to date. You know, we would get, when we had a portal that was online, only lived online, that was kind of like little bits and pieces of information about each country. And so it had things like the GDP figures, which if we were doing a print version, say you're planning to publish it in 2020. So you're doing all the editing in 2019, which means you're probably looking at statistics from 2017, 2016, 2018, somewhere in there. So when you publish this in 2020, people are going to be looking at figures that are 3-4 years old. And that was expected. That wasn't a big deal. And then you go online and we would have librarians that would be emailing us like right now saying, how come you don't have the GDP numbers for Mexico in 2019? You'd have to politely say, well, the year 2019 is still going on. So we can't, short of predicting what the numbers will be, we can't give you this information yet. But you know, that's a huge change of expectations. And editorially, that becomes a big burden as far as to take, for example, that country of the world portal that we thought was a great idea turned out to be a terrible idea, because you can imagine every morning when you wake up, you know, there's an election somewhere, there's a coup somewhere, there's an outbreak of something somewhere, and everybody is going to Google, or, you know, whatever SaaS product that you have where you have this information is going to look that stuff up, and all they're going to see is that it's out of date. So the amount of research it takes to keep that update was brutal compared to, say, the encyclopedia set that we had on Greek and Roman mythology, which was the best ever because it was up to date. If we had published it 1,000 years ago, it would have been up to date. 1,000 years from now, it's going to be up to date. At the same time, I think where that's created space or opportunity, at least for us in CXL, and this is where one of the things that we're working on is, you take something like Google Analytics 101, like how to get your Google Analytics setup done correctly. It's something that changes all the time because every time Google Analytics changes their UI, you have to get new screenshots, or they change the menu locations. So it has that really high cost of updating it, which is a burden. But at the same time, if you can commit to keeping it up to date, there's a chance for you to build your brand on, okay, somebody runs a search for how to install Google Analytics, and they see CXL and they say, oh, I can trust that their stuff is up to date. And it is a choice of sort of where you put resources. But if all you're looking to do is evergreen content that never changes, there's going to be that opportunity for other people, even if they choose like a small niche of say like 3 or 4 posts that basically require somebody to look at them every month to see if they need to be updated. You can build a sense of a brand that cares about their content enough to be a reliable source, which then ultimately, hopefully, becomes a reason that you can't rank first for everything, but maybe if you rank 4th or 5th and you've built the expectation in readers' minds that they can trust that your stuff is up to date, maybe that's a reason they scroll down a little bit and choose your result versus saying that we basically have to be first because people have no associations with our brand to have any reason to look for it.
That is something I noticed, that there's, you know, I went to the CXL blog and there was a lot of content that have been starting getting updated. How do you decide which content to update? Or do you just look at, hopefully you don't look at all your blog posts, your content, and be like, okay, this one needs to be updated, or that one needs to be updated.
So from a baseline, we have about 650 posts published over the last 8 years that we're looking at any given time. So it's a pretty big set of posts. And obviously, historically, when people think of content, they think of blogs. It's sort of like a publish and forget. Like you're seeing a timeline move past, and as you publish it, it's like, oh, yeah, well, it's out of date. But of course, it's out of date. It's a blog post. Like that's what happens over time. And so, you know, I think the person who's put the best, distilled the theory on this the best is probably Jimmy Daly from Animals, who talked about the idea of your blog being a library, not a publication, with that being the primary impetus, which is you're creating this hub of resources that you commit to keeping accurate, up-to-date as much as possible, versus saying it's a publication where, you know, you publish it and that issue's from 2013 and it had whatever information was there in 2013. The primary catalyst that we had was, a couple months after I started, of course, every content marketer you're starting and you're just hoping that this trend of up and to the right in analytics just keeps going. And of course, what happens like a month and a half after I get there, Google decides that, you know what, there's a lot of old content that you haven't kept up to date. So we're just going to bump some of those posts down. So immediately, you know, it was working with, I think, somewhere like a 20 to 30% dip in traffic, like a couple months after I started. So instead of cruising for a while, it was sort of like, all right, well, what do we need to do now? Because we need to think about more than just sort of publishing sequentially. And so there was I ran an SEO audit and basically found out that this was the primary reason. There was a really strong correlation between age of posts and those that had dipped in positions. And it makes sense. I think it makes sense for Google. If you have a post that was on installing Google Tag Manager from 2014, that they probably shouldn't have that high on page one anymore. But then it was a process of triage, which we have kind of an up-to-date Google Sheet now that pulls in users over the last 90 days and then year-over-year change for users in the last 90 days, along with overall impressions, what else, a couple other metrics that basically kind of helps us continue to surface the age of the post, when it was last updated. So we can kind of spot like, okay, here's a post that historically has been a strong traffic driver, but we've seen a dip in traffic and it's, you know, it kind of qualifies as an older post on the site. And then both working internally and working with some freelancers, we've basically gone through and updated those in kind of all the ways you'd expect to update them. And for me, really, this is kind of a phase one of what we ultimately want to work toward as far as that idea of that library of resources, which is saying, at the very least, we have to take out, and this is another learning from the encyclopedia days, which we talked about capital M mistakes and lowercase m mistakes. And so when you publish a print set, just praying that you didn't, you know, misspell a word on the cover of, you know, 1,000 volumes of something that you just spent $100,000 on at the printer. When we would get print sets back, we just wouldn't open them because we knew when we sent it to the printer, they were right. So it's like the last thing you want to do is open the cardboard box and see that you screwed something up. So you'd spend a year updating this and then you just won't ever want to look at it again. So when you're doing print, after you print encyclopedia set, it goes to reviewers, and these little reviewers tend to be a fair influence on what librarians end up buying. So what you're really afraid of is getting a bad review in one of these publications that libraries pay attention to. So you're looking to avoid the capital M mistakes, which are basically things that a reviewer is going to find and say, oh my gosh, I can't believe they have Abraham Lincoln being born in 1945. Like, you know, the kind of stuff that's really, really bad. You try to avoid the capital M mistakes. If you have the lowercase m mistakes, you know, the misspelled word, the missed comma, something like that, as long as it's sporadic enough, the reviewer is probably not going to hammer you for that. So for us at CXL Blog right now, the really outdated stuff, those are the capital M mistakes. You know, if we have a tutorial on Google Tag Manager and it's just, you can't follow along, those are the capital M mistakes. Once we get those out of the way, then it's going to be a process, okay, let's look at the lowercase m mistakes and let's figure out, you know, is this really seem like it's spot on for what the user intent is for that query? You know, could we provide videos instead of just images somewhere? And then those aren't really even mistakes, but sort of that gradual process of refinement, knowing that it's iterative, knowing that you're going to continue to build kind of a different triage doc, but that it's never ending. And that's, you know, I think sort of a change in mindset is thinking about, okay, whereas the previous focus was solely on production, pushing something new out, now it's more about looking at the overall health of the resources that we have and how we can improve those, knowing that it might at times make more sense to push more resources towards updating and improving than it does to continuously publish stuff. After 8 years and 700 blog posts, the stuff that we really should cover and people expect us to cover at CXL, that stuff's been covered. So why do we go and cover, why should we invest resources necessarily in pushing out more content on tangential topics when we're letting some stuff that's really core to who we are and what we should know languish a bit?
I have some follow-up questions to that. Why is it capital M and little m? I'm sure there's like a historical reason for
it. Oh, just capital M and lowercase m. Did I say middle m?
No, sorry. Lowercase m. Like what? Why m? Like is it like just mistake? Oh, sorry, mistake. The m stands. Yeah. Oh, okay, all right.
Lowercase m mistake. Yeah, yeah.
All right, okay, that's cool. That totally makes sense. I thought it was like some kind of trivia or something like that.
And you can imagine that, you know, that still exists kind of in our modern context of if say you publish a blog post, a capital M mistake to me is something where somebody writes a comment on the blog or in social media, they're like, oh, this is totally wrong, or they missed this. That to me is still the capital. There's something that motivates somebody to actively criticize what is there versus the lowercase m being something that maybe you'd like to weed out in the way you'd like to weed out copy editing things, but it's not something that somebody's going to necessarily comment on.
The second follow-up is, once you update a post, how do you let Google know that you've updated it? Do you just change the publication time, or is there a specific tag, or you just ask Google to recrawl that specific page?
Sure. Sort of all of the above. There's, Ross Hudgens, who runs Siege Media, which is a big content marketing agency. They, in their experience, they look at it as roughly 5% of the content needs to change for Google to sort of honor your new published date. It's not a hard and fast rule. I think obviously you can see where this can and has been taken the wrong way, which is just to sort of update all the published dates, even though you don't really change anything. So again, it's like anytime you start to think that you can game Google, it's probably not going to be a great long-term strategy. But then in Google Search Console, you can just ask Google to recrawl the URL, and it'll expedite that process a little bit. But to be honest, if you're for the amount that most of our blog posts get crawled, it might mean that it updates the published date an hour or two sooner than it otherwise would, but it's not really a big difference maker. It'll find it and make the change. And obviously, if you make those updates, you change the published date, but you don't see that turning up in Google, then that can be probably a pretty good indicator that Google's not seeing this as, you know, an honest and full update. But it's always a push. And then this is, true. I think it's always a push of you want to do right by the users. You want to provide the most comprehensive updates as possible, but you're also on a budget doing this. And so you're not trying to do like the minimal amount just so that Google will recognize the change. But at the same time, it's like everybody knows what you could potentially do. And I think it's an important thing for people to understand that, these same decisions get made when people are publishing encyclopedias just as they do in content marketing. So obviously content marketing has liabilities and gets knocked sometimes as basically being, kind of like disguised advertising in sort of the negative sense. But the same decisions of how many times do you proofread something? How many images do you include? How much time do you spend doing research? Those all apply. Everybody is working on a budget at every level, at the New York Times, in academia, publishing encyclopedias, doing content marketing. So it's a reality of publishing in general. And again, you just try to get rid of those big capital M mistakes and deal with the small ones and try to change, get better your process over time. But the main thing that excites me about content marketing as far as potential is that, I was there as the print encyclopedias went away, and in general, encyclopedias continue to kind of dwindle. That means, we were doing revisions in 2011 on budgets from the 1990s. So obviously there are sacrifices to the quality that happened because of that. Meanwhile, all that money's flowed into content marketing. So you have companies now that have a financial incentive to spend far more money content than any encyclopedia ever would. So there's a potential there to really do some of the best work in content if people choose to invest resources that way. The challenge being, obviously, it does cost money. It's always the long-term play. It's always more than the sort of minimum viable product that you need to rank your clicks or, get shares, get links. So it's sort of, you have to have somebody in that company that has a vision and wants to do that, knowing that they're probably investing more on the front end than they would have to get the same near-term metrics.
Well, when we come back in just a moment, Derek explains how he splits up his time between updating old content and actually creating new content and the types of articles that he's looking for to publish at CXL. So thank you for the sponsor for this episode again, Rank Science. Rank Science is the easiest way to grow your organic traffic and get your content ranking higher in Google. They have this AI-powered platform that gives your content team superpowers. And what I mean by that is two things. First, Rank Science uses real-time search data and some kind of algorithm they've created to help you craft content that is highly relevant to searchers' intent. They help map out directly what users are searching for specific keywords. You don't have to guess that searchers' intent anymore. This allows you to optimize past blog posts and plan out and create new ones,
giving you a step-by-step plan for easy success. Now, the second thing they do for customers with a lot of landing pages, you can use their A/B testing platform, which easily tests which HTML changes causes an uplift in search traffic. As an added bonus, this platform also allows you to make SEO enhancements to your website without having to get engineers and bothering them to make the updates. Now, RankSign is used by hundreds of companies to grow organic traffic from startups to publicly traded companies, including customers like BuildZoom, GoBelly, Sweetness, and Career Karma. You can sign up for a risk-free 30-day trial at rankscience.com/growtoday, or you can find that link in the description. Also, if you don't like ads like this, support me for as little as $2 per episode for an ad-free version of this podcast and get an early access. You get it a day before everybody else. You also know who I have coming up as guests. Be part of our private Slack group and have monthly video calls with me if you want. Go to patreon.com/growtoday or find the link in the description to help with the cost of maintaining and growing this podcast. Enough about this. Let's jump back into my chat with Derek.
One other question I had was, are you finding that you're adding more to those things that you're updating, or you're subtracting, or it's about staying the same?
Yeah, column A and column B. I think you know, we've always been long form, so pretty much everything is somewhere over 2,000 words. So I think for the most part, it hasn't been adding. It's a lot of it has been about clarifying. And this is one of the challenges we've had from a brand perspective is we started as kind of, we're doing stuff for the advanced content marketer. We're not doing the basic introductory 101 stuff. But you look at what's happening in search results, and Google's continuing to elevate a lot of really, really basic stuff to the point that often for, take a query like A-B testing, it's something where we have this really robust guide on it, and something that's completely in our wheelhouse in which we can cite tons of other resources on our site for. It's a single blog post that you could go to and really do a, be a very proficient A-B tester after you go through it. Well, what ranks first for A-B testing, it's literally like a dictionary entry of what is A-B testing. And that's probably a couple of the first results are those kind of glossary introductions. And so it's a question now of when you go back through, we still want to be for the advanced marketer. We still want to have the comprehensive resources, but how do we maybe restructure? Do we need to have like a TLDR section at the top, something to kind of balance this accommodation? Because obviously Google's not making those decisions to include introductory content simply because Google thinks it's great. It's because that's what people are asking for, because you probably have, you know, you got more mobile searchers who are looking for some of the more superficial answers to things. So how do you accommodate that? Well, at the same time, you know, we don't want to be the person, you know, the company that has just this massive, you know, really basic introductory stuff. We want to keep that, but at the same time, try to find that balance. So when we go through, it might be adding an HTML table of contents to make stuff a little more findable, to move some definitions up to the top. You know this, as you get more advanced in every field, there's sort of more caveats, more nuances. Historically, we've kind of included those at the front, and now we're maybe pushing those a little bit farther down to try to get front and center in the introduction. Here's a definition, here are the key points, and then we'll include the caveats and other things farther below, rather than kind of like bringing all that in at the very beginning. But it's you know, again, it's iterative. We don't think that with this first round of updates that we're going to hit on all those things. It's trying to make some of those improvements, and then once we get rid of the big hairy scary stuff, then we can go back and keep refining this over time.
You said the first round of updates. How long has this round been? Did you just start updating recently, or was this like a project that started like a year?
It's been going on for about a year, and again, you know, it's a question of sort of resources. It started basically, we wanted to make sure that, you know, this was what the SEO audit kind of told us that was probably the issue, but we wanted to make sure this was where we pushed tons of money into it. So we updated about 20 posts, and then it was very clear. It was, you know, kind of night and day of often like posts that dropped off of page one, you update it a day or two later, it's right back to where it was. So we sort of knew that it was going to work. And then we had some freelancers who came in to help add some bandwidth. I think we've updated out of the 650, you figure if we're doing about 90 posts a year, you figure about 200 of those were in the last couple of years. So those are really okay for the most part. So you're looking at about 400 posts. We've done the kind of most urgent, I think about 150 or so by now. But we're continuing to work on it. It's just a matter of trying to get balance the ROI of there are the questions of, okay, this post might be outdated, but it gets very little traffic. So at what point do you go in and spend the resources to do that? Or it might be that it gets very little traffic because it's not very up to date. So balancing all those things, again, everybody's on a budget. So it's balancing that with the new content production, but just you know, chipping away. You get the ones that are the big outliers and then just work backward from there.
I actually want to talk about outliers where, like, you know, updated this post and then all of a sudden it increased organic traffic to that specific post by X percent. Is there any specific ones that really, like, whoa, that was a huge, huge impact just based on just updating this content?
Sure. I mean, for the most part, I would say that I think the average of the first 20 that we did as a test set, I think the average was like 130% increase when you looked at the before and after period. When you average them, like all the sort of, if you calculated all the traffic that came before each update was made versus after, it was triple digits of traffic growth. So, I mean, again, it's not terribly hard to do. You know, one of the challenges that we have, or that I have personally, as far as measurement for our blog is with 650 different posts, all on these disparate topics, you know, every morning when you come in and you look at rankings, you look at traffic, it's, oh, this post is up by a position. This one's down by a position. This one's down by two positions. This one's up by four positions. So you're looking at that spread happening across hundreds and hundreds of posts. So it can be hard necessarily to pinpoint. It's not that you have, you know, you're a company that has three core service areas and you can kind of see like, okay, in general, we're trending well for this one service area, set of keywords. We're not so much for the other ones. It can be hard sometimes looking through to pick out exactly what's going on, especially because a change of one or two positions can be a triple digit change to traffic. So a lot of these, like, it used to be fourth and say it got 1,000 visits a month, it dropped to seventh and it gets like 300 because you're looking at people that are, you know, maybe on mobile or just not scrolling at all. So some of these minor movements, even of a few positions, can be a triple digit different in traffic, which can be really scary if you come in and look at analytics and you see that post, oh, it's down like 60% week over week. You go in and look at it, it's like, oh, it used to be in third, now it's fourth. Or like, you know, often they move like the people also ask box. They'll move that up or down and it'll maybe mean instead of having two blue links above it, it only has one. And you were that one that got bumped below. Well, that's like a 40% hit to your traffic. So you can get pretty neurotic about it. I mean, this is, I guess, the cross section of SEO and content marketing. But
I'm also really curious about where you see your time going forward in terms of a percentage between new content, like actually publishing new articles, versus like going back and updating past articles.
Sure, and you know, it's a great question. It's one that I haven't really settled on yet. It's still kind of testing. And it's also, when you're, you know, a startup that continues to grow, there's also the chance that, you know, we could increase the resources on the content side over time. So you're also trying to like triangulate what you're doing, plus knowing that if the company keeps growing at a steady rate, at some point you may be able to have somebody else come in underneath. Right now, historically, it's been about 60 to 70% of my time is on getting the two posts out per week that we publish most weeks. Most of those are people that we find that we're not the easiest place in the world to get published. People that are really, really good active practitioners that can come right up what they're doing. So that's, you know, reaching out, reviewing outlines, reviewing drafts, getting stuff published in WordPress. That component, then the other 30 to 40% is either helping manage some of the freelancers that are doing the updates, sort of sneaking in an update here or there. Basically, it takes us anywhere from maybe 2 to 6 hours to do a post update, just depending on what the post is and how much needs to be updated in it. So sometimes, you know, you can get to like a Friday afternoon and you're brain dead, but you can go in and update a post versus having to write a new one or review somebody's. So it's been a nice balance just to have that different set of work. But, you know, if it were up to me, and I'm sure every other content marketer, it's like, oh yeah, we'd have like multiple full-time people doing all these and they'd be done tomorrow and then we'd keep going. But
that's so good. Another question that I have before I switch gears is, you're talking about tracking positions. I know there's multiple tools and those tools have their advantage and disadvantage. Are you, which one are you looking at for those positions? Is it Moz, Ahrefs?
Sure. We use Ahrefs. I've used them all, but you know, as some people know, the great part about being an agency is that you have like all the tools. and then you go in house. It's like, which one would you like? So it's Ahrefs has been what we've used. I think they're all sort of good enough. The one that I actually love, love, love that only sort of exists anymore, there was a tool called Stat that was based in Vancouver. They got bought by Moz. And so I think a lot of their stuff has been folded into Moz, but their rank tracking was phenomenal. It was geared mainly toward enterprise clients, so it wasn't the cheapest thing in the world. But for us, from a ranking perspective, the balance, of course, like you can look at traffic numbers, but we have pretty heavy seasonality as far as every weekend, obviously traffic goes down. Once you get on the holidays, traffic drops off a cliff. You know, the summer traffic goes down, the sort of standard B2B flow of traffic. So if you're really trying to keep an eye on things, often for us, rankings can be a better indicator. I also, Google Search Console is still pretty good for rankings if you know how to kind of, you know, manipulate it enough so that you're not looking at average rankings and kind of getting distorted data. It's a good second step too, but it's, you know, Ahrefs, I think it updates every 5 days for us. You can pay for a higher plan to update every 3 days. Stat was every day. So it was just that hit of rankings every day that you don't get now. But
I want to switch gears. We've been talking a lot about updated old content. Let's talk about new content. How do you define, what's your definition of a good article submission? Like, say, let's say somebody submits you an article, you come in as the editor, it's like, this is bad, or this is great. Like, what is that things that you're looking for?
Sure. I mean, for us, you know, we know that most of our traffic, you know, 80-ish% is going to come from organic search. So obviously having some kind of organic potential is helpful. We have seen stuff that's done really well without that organic potential. We had a post by Lars Lofgren earlier that was on, it was called Don't Build Growth Teams. So you can imagine, like, it struck a nerve and ended up making it up Hacker News, which, you know, is good for a nice 5-figure hit of traffic. But as far as longevity, most of the people when we work with, I tell, you know, people that come in, it's like, you know, the future, the long-term value is going to be organic. You know, we have a big email list, you know, we have people that are on, you know, RSS feeds for our content, but ultimately the long-term value is going to be from organic. So it helps to at least see if there's some way to give it some kind of angle that is going to work well in organic search. Other than that, you know, I like to use the term derivative content for sort of the really terrible stuff that makes it out there a lot, which is, you know, somebody goes in, they Google a topic, they look at the first 5 or 7 search results, and they basically create a post that's a mashup of those things. That's the kind of content that kind of just needs to die and not exist anymore. There are a couple of quick ways to really elevate content. The stuff that is really helpful for us and that we try to incorporate when we do stuff is, can you get some expert opinions on this? You know, if you're writing about a topic, if you have the core kind of how-tos and best practices in there that are going to be pretty similar across posts, can you also go and get, you know, little bits and pieces of quotes from people that's going to add something that's unique, original content to that? Or can you go and pull some original data that you've done one way or the other to add some component that's really unique to that post is a big difference. The other thing that is super apparent when people submit is whether or not they've actually done what they're talking about. So you can see the people that they might perfectly include each of the best practices, but you know they've never done it. Like, it might be something like, you know, for instance, like how to audit your content on your site or something like that. They might have all the right practices and everything in there, but you know they've never actually done it. You can just kind of feel that as you go through it, because it tends to be that there's a certain kind of lack of specificity in some of the recommendations that just kind of fall out, where you have people that are practitioners. They have, it's kind of hard to put your finger on sometimes, but you can see just the specificity of the recommendations or the little asides or the caveats and the nuance that they're able to include from having done it as a practitioner is just very different. So if somebody can show up to me with something that has search potential, it has either, you know, interview expert opinion, or it has that data and it has that practitioner element to it, you're heading in the right direction for sure.
You might get hit up with a lot of submissions after this.
Great. Yeah. Good. No, I mean, we're happy to. I mean, it's a pretty good symbiotic relationship, because and this is, from my perspective as an editor, one of the hardest things for me to do is to find those really good practitioners that don't. So what happens is you have the people that are the marketing famous people that everybody knows. They don't have the time. You know, the Pep Lyas of the world, right?
Yeah, I get it, but it's funny. Yeah. I've never heard it that way. Marketing famous.
So it's like Pep doesn't have the time to write a blog post for us. He doesn't have the time to write a 2,500 word blog post. And odds are, you know, he's probably either, you know, he's the CEO of a SaaS company now, basically, you know, so he's not necessarily in the weeds as a practitioner as much as he used to be. So he would even tell you, if you talk to him, that he wouldn't feel like he's in the weeds as much anymore, that he would be the person necessarily that you should talk to if you want a sort of bleeding edge CRO practitioner perspective on something. So those people in general aren't necessarily, and they also don't have the ROI. Like, he doesn't need to have a guest post somewhere. Whereas there are people that are doing the work that don't have huge social media followings or anything else that have the really cutting edge stuff, but they don't necessarily have the access to where somebody's going to think to ask them directly. So these are the people that I've tried to find different ways to find. You know, they have both the phenomenal information and the real willingness, and they get the ROI from doing the work because it's useful for them to have that visibility. To try to surface some more of those people, that's perfect case scenario for me, because they're hard to find otherwise.
Yeah, that's so true. I think it's You're right. I think there, just because of the prevalence of internet, there's a lot of like bad content, and everybody wants to be marketing famous or famous in general, right? I'm curious, what's next for you? I mean, are you trying to be marketing famous, or you know, are you writing a book or an encyclopedia in the future? Like, what is your personal project that you're doing for yourself?
I've always sort of, I think my tagline that I have on LinkedIn is that if you're producing the best version of something, I'm interested. That continues to kind of be the driving force. One of the things that is a little bit different for CXL compared to some other places that makes it a good home for me is that Pat built the company on the blog and he knows the value of content marketing. So the buy-in at the highest level of the company is 100% of the content marketing. Whereas if it's something where a company historically has been doing traditional marketing or they've been using other channels, and then you're trying to layer content marketing on top of that, there can be a lot of skepticism of that. So the buy-in at CXL is really, really good, which is generally what you need to sort of be able to experiment, to get the resources, to do things like the post updates, which I'm sure plenty of people would say, well, why do we need to update that? It's old stuff. But I can go in and say, hey, Pep, look, we need to update 650 posts. And we need to keep these things perpetually up to date forever. And it's going to take resources. And the answer is yes. So I think there's a lot of satisfaction, a lot of good neurotic satisfaction for me in sort of trying to bring all this together and to get it to that place where it's a library that you feel like is reliable. And that's, you know, we basically started that work a little over a year ago. And I don't think I'm halfway even finished with that yet, as far as where we want it to be. So that's going to keep me very sort of busy and intellectually stimulated for a while.
That's good.
That's enough for now. That's enough for now. I did buy the domain for my name, but I haven't done anything with it other than the big, it was $12.99 for. So that's, we just migrated from version XL to CXL. So we are officially in for all CXL and CXL only. And that was obviously, buying a 3-letter domain was a bit more of an investment than buying my namesake. So it's a good humbling experience to have 3 random letters be worth vastly more than your name, but makes it cheap to maintain.
I did see that you transitioned to CXL. I mean, were you part of that process to make sure that everything gets redirected properly?
Yeah, so that's a pretty big SEO lift. Obviously, there's a huge risk in there. It was an interesting experience for me because I've done a lot of site transitions before. Obviously, they can go wrong in lots of different ways. You know, it only takes one robots.txt file blocking crawlers from the entire site to just destroy something. And I've seen them go bad. Often at the agency that I was at, we got so many clients who were like, the last agency destroyed us with a bad site we launched. We need help. But we knew there was a lot at stake. The difference that I saw with ours, which is, you know, it's still rolling out now. It's where basically this week has been the primary week of flux as far as seeing the URL swap from conversionxl to cxl.com. But the biggest difference that I've seen is historically what I would see generally is you move from, you know, RamleyJohn to DerekLeeson.com. Usually what would happen is once you put all those 301s in, the RamleyJohn URLs drop from the index, and then the Derek Leeson ones start like on page 2 or 3, and they kind of slowly work their way up. What we've seen so far is that even a few days after we basically had all the 301s in and put in the site move notification Google Search Console, was that Google actually kept the conversionxl.com URLs in there for several days. And it's been basically slowly indexing cxl.com. Every day it indexes a few hundred more URLs. And now finally this week we've seen them swap out. So for me, it's looked like a far more deliberate process of a site migration on Google's part than I've seen in the past, which I think is probably because it's a bigger site that generates a few million visits. So Google kind of wants to make sure it gets it right too. So it's been interesting in that sense. I'm hoping and optimistic that as I've seen things swap out, it seems like, okay, we're a couple positions below, but not several pages below. So I'm hoping that's almost going to be a 1-for-1 swap by the time it's all done and be pretty efficient. But it's been, from an SEO perspective, it's been kind of something I hadn't seen.
That's interesting. Yeah, well, definitely like ConversionXL and CXL has a lot of content. I actually transitioned my podcast domain from growthmarketing.today to growthtoday.fm like in July. And man, I had 1,500 pages at that point. And like I had to redirect them all. I can't imagine what you guys had to go through with like 800-900 like pages and posts that you have to transition over.
Yeah, it wasn't as bad as it could have been. And one of the things that is, I think, for anybody, if you're just starting in SEO, one of the great things is that complexity and the learning curve is generally based on the size of the site, not necessarily the importance of the site. So you can be a huge and prominent website, but if you only have a few hundred pages and they're pretty static, from an SEO standpoint, it's really simple. At the same time, I remember when I started our agency in Richmond, we were working with like local businesses, and there was nothing like a car dealership website to get you up to speed on your SEO skills, because they had all the different like variables and filters for different like make model things. The sites were always a disaster. There were always devs somewhere just like trying to crash the site all the time. But once you get to some of the bigger websites, some of the learning isn't there. If you're like in an agency starting, like I couldn't think of better advice from an SEO perspective of go work at a small agency somewhere, because you're going to work with these mom and pop sites that are going to teach you a whole lot more than when you get to some big fancy agency and you're working with like a Fortune 100 company and they take 6 months just to approve everything. And it's just a really slow process versus the smaller websites that give you access, like, oh, you want access to our HD access or, you know, file, or you want, you know, which can totally crash a site really quick. Like, oh, sure, go ahead. Who cares? It's not going to happen with a big site.
I want to talk about trends in content marketing that you're seeing. Like, what are things that you're probably more tapped into content working at CXL and like working in content for a longer time than a lot of people. What are things that you foresee things happening, and what are you doing about it, and what should people do about that?
Sure. So to me, the big one is that, and we kind of touched on this earlier, which was you started with, you know, just had a bunch of really bad content, and then it got slightly better. And then people did the whole skyscraper technique that Brian Dean kind of popularized, which was saying, okay, you look at what ranks well and you basically do an outsized version of that. So if the top ranking is, you know, 2,000 words, you do the 4,000 word post. And I think we've sort of reached the end of that, where we have about as much as we can handle. But what's been lost over that time is you see the sameness of everything that's out there. Like, you Google a topic like, increased SaaS retention, you know, page one is going to be nothing but like 2,000 to 6,000 word ultimate guides, definitive guides, like whatever it is. There are really these sort of soulless how to's. And so I think the future is now people saying, okay, like, hang on, let's pump the brakes. How can we make this more efficient for readers? And how, more importantly, can we actually put some element of our brand into this? How can we get our brand voice into this content? From CXL, as far as how we're doing that, one of that ways is to try to say that, okay, we promise that we're going to be up to date. So that is part of the spending of resources on updating content, is saying that that's one of the ways that our content will differentiate itself. At the same time, one of the interesting conversations, so this goes back to like one of the classic and enjoyable Slack conversations with Pep now, which was, just recently, you know, there was a while where he would sort of post some of these shorter rants that were kind of like his editorial take on certain trends, like competitive analysis. And he would go on a rant saying, like, don't just blindly follow your competitors. Most of them don't know what they're doing anyway, and you're just wasting your time. So we have that post. And then we also had a post that was your classic, like, 8 steps to do a competitive analysis. And so what you end up with is that 8 steps to do a competitive analysis, that's the one that ranks well. That's the one that drives traffic. His post, that's the rant, has this really interesting and valuable editorial perspective, but it basically has no acquisition channel, because there's no way, it was published years ago, we're not going to like keep retweeting it every day. We're not going to send it out the email list. So basically, it's sort of like hanging out there on an island. So what I did, and did it sort of clumsily, but what we'd like to do smarter as time goes on, is saying, how do we incorporate that editorial perspective that's in the rant into the standard how-to post? Because the reality is, we think from our perspective, how we look at marketing, this is a really important take-home message. But we've got to get that take-home message into the post that has the distribution working for it. So basically, what we want to do is figure out, okay, if right now you look at your blog, you look at your content, and you think, I have my keyword-targeted stuff, and I have my brand-targeted stuff, like the stuff that's on brand, that's the editorial stuff, and then I have the standard how-to, you've got to figure out a way right now to get those two things into the same post. Because the keyword-targeted stuff is going to be your distribution channel, and the brand stuff is going to be how you make your content stand out when all of page one is long-form content. Like, you can already imagine now there are plenty of search results where it's like everything's an amazing long-form how-to post. So now you've got to figure out something else to differentiate. It's going to be getting that brand voice back in there in those posts that probably historically, for other reasons, you may have separated out. You've now got to pull that stuff back in and really weave that tone of voice and other things into your content to be a reason that somebody clicks your result, even if you're ranked 3rd, 4th, or 6th over the random company they've never heard of that ranks first.
Just a couple more questions before we wrap up. What's your one piece of advice to any marketer who's trying to do more content, or maybe just content marketers in general?
Sure. I think narrower is probably another trend. The danger of the kind of scattershot blog, the way these happen is for most companies, especially smaller companies, you're thinking that organic is your only distribution channel. You don't have a million social media followers. You don't have 10,000 people on your email list. You don't have tons of paid budget. So you're thinking, we've got to succeed in search. What that often means is then you just start doing keyword research and figure out like what is some slightly relevant to my company that I can reasonably rank for. And then you end up with a blog that's sort of like all over the place. Those blogs are also all over the place with those posts that are all over the place. But you know, the only way that you can kind of work on that, and this is something that when I was an agency, I've worked with clients, we did some content marketing work, is figuring out what is that one question that you're best positioned to answer. And so an example that I had with that was we had a client that had a series of pediatric urgent care clinics. And so in theory, you could say, okay, your pediatric urgent care clinics, anything health related, kid related is on the table. Like you can cover like how to get your kids to eat vegetables. You can cover, you know, how to get your kid to brush their teeth. Like anything is related. But at the end of the day, that's how you end up with the scattershot blog, because that's how you look at this site that from a sort of domain authority, competitiveness and search perspective was somewhere in the middle. That's what they would have been able to rank for. What we did was we worked with them and said, okay, like what question are you guys really better than anybody else at answering? And it turned out that all their clinics were basically staffed by former ER physicians who were now doing pediatric urgent care. And so what they were really best positioned to answer was that question that a parent has of like, this just happened. Do I need to take my kid to urgent care or the ER? Which one do I need to go to? And so we ended up with about 10 topics, things like, you know, when is a fever dangerous for a baby? Can you get stitches at urgent care? What's the difference in cost between, you know, an x-ray at one of these places? And it built about only 10 posts, but it had this really central theme to it. And really surprisingly quickly, within a few months, they were on page one for what are, from Google's perspective, the your money or your life queries, which are the ones about either finances or health, that they pay very specific attention to as far as making sure that it's quality, credible stuff. And they're really punching above their weight as far as a brand perspective, or as far as a domain authority perspective rank there. And the only reason that happened was because it was this really comprehensive strategy. So some people talk about this kind of a hub and spoke model, but I think if you can distill it down to what is that one question, especially if you're starting out and you don't have kind of anywhere you're already going, that can be a really good way to get that, shoot for that kind of like 6, 8, 10 post content. And then that also gives you a really good baseline of what looks like on brand quality content for you as a company, rather than getting stuck with that we want to publish 2 things every week and then quality kind of goes out the door because it gets pushed out by the need for quantity.
That's great. And actually that's great advice because I'm trying to write more content. So I'll keep that in mind. Last question, where can people find out more about you and your work online? Do you have, I know DerekGleason.com is, you just bought that, but okay. Is there anywhere?
I don't even know what's there, if there's anything there. I'm on Twitter. I tweet an aggressive maybe once a week. So I try to make it useful to people. But I think for myself, it's still been really good for me the last, I think, year and a half after having been an agency perspective and going in-house and seeing some of the differences. I think now I'm starting to look, also working with freelancers and other people, I start to realize that I actually have some good processes that we built out now, some good useful sheets for things like content marketing measurement, for triaging which posts need to be updated, for triaging which posts make the most sense to do link outreach for based on whether or not in that SERP, that search engine results page, links seem to be the primary differentiator for your performance versus others. So maybe someday when I have DerekGleason.com, there'll also be some of these resources. And in the interim, somebody can just email me and I'll just give them a link to the Google sheet.
All right, I'm probably going to go ask for that. I really appreciate your time, Derek. I thank you for doing this.
Thanks a lot for having me.
Well, that was it for this episode, last episode of the year. Well, I've published, I think, 42 or 43 episodes, but it's been such a great run, and I really love this episode. My chat with Derek was just phenomenal. I had such a great time just chatting with him. I just want to share my 3 key takeaways from this, and once again, pardon me for my sickness. I have gotten sick over the holidays. My 3 key takeaways are, first, focus on the process instead of the tricks. Derek emphasizes the importance of having your focus on the right part of the process. Whether you are focusing on the content itself or blindly trying to use tricks and techniques that would allow you to market your content, really, if you have a process down, just follow through with it and the results will come. One of the processes he talked about is updating your content. And that's something that you need to think about, is any old blog posts you have, Google loves that you have updated the content, but also users, when you have updated your content, they know that you really care about the stuff that you're writing about instead of just letting it
gather spider webs and rot in the corner of your house. Second, write content that's need to know and hard to find. I love that. The two qualities of great content. Need to know differentiate itself from just nice to know. It's something people need to do their job well. And if you write that, they're gonna read it. And the second thing is hard to find. Speaks to the quality and depth of the article and not just another shallow listicles. And third, avoid the small M mistakes with your content. Derek talked about two types of mistakes. The big M is spelling mistakes and grammar mistakes, but small M are like derivative content for really terrible stuff that makes it out there in the world of content, which is somebody just going to Google and typing up a topic and looking at the first 5 and 7 search results, and they basically just create a post. It's a mashup of things. This is no longer gonna cut it anymore. Well, those are my three key takeaways. Did I miss something? Share with me your takeaways from this episode on Twitter at RamleyJohn or email me ramley@growthtoday.fm. Before I end, I just want to thank those who made this episode possible. These folks helped cover the cost of hosting and marketing tools so I can focus on getting amazing experts that you and I can learn from. I want to thank a sponsor for this episode, Rank Science. If you're in content marketing, like I said, this is pretty cool. I've never really heard about this until they told me about it. They use real-time search data and natural language processing to help you craft content that is really relevant to searchers' intent and maps directly to what users are searching for. Now, this helps you optimize past blog posts like what we talked about in this episode, or plan out and create new ones, giving you a step-by-step plan for easy success. Sign up for a risk-free 30-day trial at rankscience.com/growtoday. Anyways, that's it for this episode. Thank you for sticking around for this year. 2020 will be amazing. And for you, all of you, have a happy new year onwards and upwards in 2020. Until the next episode in the next year or the next decade, because this decade is ending. This is your host, Ramley John. And as always, keep on growing.